The city's top attorney, Donna Leong, has gone to court challenging the wording of a ballot question that's supposed to go before voters this fall. It has to do with funding public schools using a tax that historically has sat with the counties. Leong filed a complaint last week and is amending it to include home rule arguments and to include all the counties in the challenge.
The ballot question that was written by the state legislature for this proposed constitutional amendment fails to mention the most substantive effect of that amendment, which is that the legislature seeks to give itself yet another taxation power, the real property taxation power. I don't know if you recall, Catherine, but in 1978, at the Constitutional Convention, the delegates granted to the counties the exclusive authority to assess real property taxes. And they did this because all of the critical core operating services, such as police, fire, trash pickup and removal, and parks, are paid for, as well as the capital improvement projects that we need to make. And that's why the most significant effect of this constitutional amendment is the taxation power that the legislature seeks to give to itself.
But your complaint only asks for a change in the title.
Right. So that was the original complaint that was filed last week, Wednesday. The first amended complaint is much more robust. It identifies with more particularity all of the issues we feel arise out of this this proposed constitutional amendment.
Do you offer different language for the question?
We do not. I think there might be various ways to pose the question. However, the Constitution says that the legislature has to propose and actually specify what the ballot question is. So the ballot question itself cannot be changed. I don't know whether the court would consider other alternatives. We'd have to look into that further.
Have you asked for an expedited hearing?
We are going to be asking for an expedited hearing. We plan to file a motion for temporary injunction and ask the court for an expedited hearing. We would be seeking to invalidate the ballot question because it does not mention the most significant impact, which is that the legislature seeks to give itself yet another taxation power, and that is the real property taxation power. And therefore, the Constitution says that the language and meaning of a constitutional amendment has to be clear and neither misleading nor deceptive. Because it does not reflect that most significant effect, we believe that it is misleading and deceptive. And in addition, the constitutional amendment refers to, quote, investment real property, end quote. It's not clear from the constitutional amendment language what that means. And because this the draft of the Senate Bill 2922 was adopted at the last committee meeting, there really wasn't a discussion that I could find as to what encompasses investment real property. And so it's vague. And just by way of example, when someone buys a residential property for a home, and if that person hopes, as we all do, that it will appreciate in value, is that investment real property? That's the type of thing that, you know, makes us pause and made us want to file this complaint. We want to be sure that there's transparency so that the voters know when they vote on this measure about the most significant substantive effect of the proposal, which is to give those state legislature the real property taxation power.
That was Corporation Counsel Donna Leong. Now, the State Teachers Association, which represents thousands of public school educators, fired back. Union head Corey Rosenlee called the complaint frivolous and a waste of time and resources.
They should be embarrassed. I mean, this is a frivolous lawsuit that cost taxpayers money. And basically, this does not cost the constitutional amendment to fund our schools and our KK does not cost the city and counties one dime. It doesn't take away any of their money. instead of wasting time on this lawsuit, they should actually be working to see how they could actually fund our schools.
I mean, you see this as a question about supporting education.
This absolutely is a question about supporting education. We have underfunded our schools for decades, and the data shows that Hawaii teachers, when you adjust for cost of living, are the lowest paid teacher in the nation. We are 45th in the nation in per pupil expenditures. And when you look at that, what that means is this, is that our teachers are leaving in droves to teach on the mainland, and now we have 1,000 classrooms that don't have a qualified teacher. We've got to do something. And the only question is, are we going to tax the wealthiest among us? And that's what this amendment's trying to do.
I know there's always been this rub between the city and county and the state, you know, over home rule. Whenever they think that the state is crossing the line on some things, they push back.
The problem with that argument is that every other state in the entire United States uses property taxes to fund the schools. And we're not asking to tax everyone. What we're looking at is specifically, this is a very clear question, okay? Are you willing to tax second homes over $1 million to fund our schools? That's what we're looking at. And we're not asking something that is unusual. In fact, we're the unusual ones. We're the only ones that don't do this. And this is why our schools are underfunded. It's primarily because we're the only ones not to do this.
We are also structured a little bit different in that we have a statewide system and nobody else does. You know, because on the mainland, right, they use their property taxes to deal with the schools in the district.
Sure. So this would be a state surcharge. One of the biggest problems on the mainland is you may have two counties right next to each other. One's rich, one's poor. We're not doing that. In Hawaii, the good news is that, you know, we have equal funding. Unfortunately, we have equal underfunding for our schools. If we could ever be unique in the country, if we were actually to fund our schools at an equal level, we would be unique. And what we're trying to do is this state surcharge would not mean that Kauai students get less than Oahu students. In fact, it would mean that all students are equal. But right now, our schools are just so underfunded that the consequences are that we have buildings that are falling down. We have kids drinking from rusty water fountains, and many of our students, up to one-third of our students, every day go into classrooms and don't have a qualified teachers. The teachers of Hawaii are begging for help. We know what it's like. And we're saying we've got to change this. We've got to fund our schools. And this is the farthest and the best way we've ever had the opportunity to do something about it.
What was your recollection during the legislative process as to where the city and county stood on this issue?
Well, it was interesting. The counties came out against it, and they said that they shouldn't intermingle. But this is the same county that came in and asked for $500 million for rail. They asked for the TAT. So the counties have constantly asked for state money, and that has been at the detriment of our schools. 36 other states have a state surcharge on property taxes. So, again, this is something that's commonplace and not rare. The counties should be in favor of this. One of the most important things a society can do is educate its children. And when you educate your children and you invest in education, it's better for the economy, it's better for society. Yesterday, we spent $500 million to buy a new prison. What if we didn't have to buy a new prison because we actually invested in our keiki earlier? And that's the problem is that right now, we don't spend the money early on in our kids, and we have to spend too much at the back end. The mayors should be 100% for education for our keiki and should not be fighting this.
That was HSTA head Corey Rosenlee. And at last check, a hearing on the complaint had not yet been set. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your quiz. Each year, Hawaii's elementary and middle school children vote for their favorite book, and the winning author receives the coveted Nene Award. Now, in 1959, third graders at the University Elementary Laboratory School decided to create a book award using the Nene as the award's motif. Now, the first author to ever receive a Nene was Beth Lewis, who wrote The Blue Mountain. The idea of voting for the best children's author spread to other schools. So by 1964, the first statewide Nene Award was presented to Scott Odell for Island of the Blue Dolphins. Since then, the number of participating students continues to grow as Island Keiki utilize their public libraries to read and vote for their favorite writer. So for today's Backyard Quiz, can you tell us who was awarded the Nene earlier this year, back in May? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Manoa Valley Theater, presenting the musical comedy Pageant. Six male contestants vie for the title of Miss Glamoress, decided each night by members of the audience. On now through September 16th. ManoaValleyTheater.com.
Smart Yields is a three-year-old startup which just got an infusion of cash to help small farmers get food safety certified. We talked to Vince Kimura about what this means for Hawaii and potentially for farmers around the world.
This grant specifically is to help small farmers around the nation, starting in Hawaii, help get food safety certified. And what that means is twofold. First and foremost is it gets them to be compliant, which once they become compliant and audited and certified, it allows them to sell their produce in a much larger market. So, for example, if you want to sell to certain restaurants or schools or hotels, many of those vendors are now requiring some sort of certification because of liability.
Right. The federal government has passed some laws, and they want to be able to track in case there's a problem with food.
Yeah. So the Food Safety Modernization Act, or FSMA, as they call it, was the law that Obama signed in 2011. And the last time the federal government had actually updated their laws was in the 30s, so 1938 to be exact. So it's been a long time. And one of the big things they added in there is about food defense as well. So taking a look at how, you know, tainting our food supply, our water sources, different things could actually cause a huge, huge impact into, obviously, our daily lives. Agriculture is hard. It's really tough. And as one of my mentors has always said, if you can't make money, you're not going to farm. So how can we almost standardize a lot of the things so that people understand exactly where they align, you know, and then they can actually improve or improve how they do their operations? I think one of the biggest challenges, obviously, being the fact the majority of our farms, not only in Hawaii, in the nation, and globally, are they're small farmers by acreage. So most of the tools available for these small farmers are not cost-effective. They definitely don't provide the insights that farmers need. You can provide data in terms of different sensors or UAVs or satellite, but what does that mean? Tell me when to harvest. Tell me what to plant. Tell me when to water. Tell me how much to water. And that's where a lot of this starts off, which is why for Smart Yields, we looked at food safety as a pillar of a lot of this technology. Because if we can show to a small farmer from day one, we can not only help them get certified, which means now they can sell to a much wider base, but what North Shore Economic Vitality Partnership is doing, North Shore EVP with Kevin Kelly, is they're creating a food hub. And that's really how small farmers can stay competitive. is by aggregating their different harvests, putting it together on the same grading schedule, providing other value chain products, and selling to larger clients that need it.
So it's really about becoming more efficient.
Absolutely. Efficiency is the cornerstone of what GAP and Group GAP is.
And I guess we have to step back because for so long we've had the whole plantation structure in place. We saw things change with sugar going out, a pineapple going in a different direction. Everybody's been looking for diversified ag, and then you've got these smaller farms farming on these, what was very large parcels, right? Plantation tracks, I guess.
Yeah, one of the things we've been doing in the last 3 years is learning other frameworks and best practices globally. We ourselves are looking at technology and data and how others around the world are doing it, which is one of the reasons why we had to go to Holland. The Netherlands is pretty awesome. For a country that small, with one-fifth the population involved in agriculture, they have more millionaire farmers than anyone else in the world. So how do they do it? And that's where we went and learned, and that's why also why we opened up a company, actually a entity there. It's called a BV, a Dutch BV, to really learn about what we're doing. But the other thing, too, is that they realize that our technology, what we're doing in terms of aggregating data and providing insights for small farmers was extremely valuable because they have a lot of outdoor farms as well that's not being serviced by the fact that they focus mostly on indoor growing.
And so how will this work on the North Shore?
So with the North Shore EVP, they just kicked off their next cohort. And so today they've had 19 farmers with about 400 acres under purview with this Group GAP program. So we essentially, because they've already done this a couple times, we're listening, we're understanding, we're asking a lot of questions. Obviously, for Hawaii's agriculture, which is very synonymous with other locations around the world, is English isn't the first language for a lot of these folks. So you have to look at, you know, the usability of technology. And you have to listen, and you have to understand exactly how would you fit this technology in their hands. That's also one of the reasons why when we created our app initially, we realized that maybe that's too advanced. Maybe they just need a text message system or a call system to understand what the data means.
And it's some of the basic stuff like hand washing, right?
Yeah. it really does come to very basic things. For example, you know, do you have a bathroom within 400 meters of fields. So accessibility, because if you don't, then obviously you're going to have to use the bathroom in the fields, which obviously causes a lot of potential risks for human-borne pathogens. And of course, hand washing stations are a must to ensure they don't spread any sort of fecal matter.
Now, we had the head of the food sanitation branch for the health department in here, and they just recently rolled out some rules, and they're going to start enforcing it in September. That requires the employees, at least one employee who had this food sanitation certification, to be on property at all times. And he said generally you can walk into an establishment and for the first 15 minutes figure out if they've got a system in place. Is that same kind of a thing for ag?
Yeah, very much so. I think once you learn the methodology and you truly understand why you're doing it this way, it really changes your mindset. I think it's a lot like you're looking for risks. You're looking for potential hazards that might cause, you know, both harm to the employee, obviously harm to the end user, the consumer, and just trying, you know, really trying to make sure that what you sell is not going to cause someone harm. And because 46 million Americans each year get some sort of foodborne illness, when you have immune compromised, you know, keiki or elderly or whatnot, or kupuna, it's really challenging. It's really tough.
I'm sure you're looking at this as if we can set this up as a model, then other groups and other farmers can learn from this.
Yeah, being the first in the state, it's pretty exciting. Fortunately, we're riding off of 14 other states who've implemented Group GAP, which is what the North Shore EVP has done. What we're doing for Smart Yields particularly is creating an app that can integrate both with their system, Group GAP, as well as with what's called Harmonized GAP. There's all these jargon terms mm-hmm. that they use. And GAP is a global standard. Actually, it's kind of interesting. Just last week, the largest body of food safety oversight globally basically said that Harmonized GAP will be considered on a global scale. So if Hawaii can lead the charge, especially with its very multilingual, multicultural workforce, and really making it something that's easy to do, and especially lowering the labor cost. I think that's one thing that when you look at data and numbers, when they implemented the Group GAP program in Michigan State, they basically saw to adopt get certified and maintained for the first 2 years costs about $25,000. And then when they implemented group gap and tried it, they saw that basically that reduced greatly to about $8,000 for the first 2 years. So it's a significant savings, especially if you have to employ someone anywhere from about 0.25 to about one full-time employee just to manage this.
Right, but it's all about best practices.
It is. It is. And just basically sharing this information, of course, education is key for everything, and teaching them, here's what someone else is doing, and here's why they're doing it this way versus this way.
Is it going to be tricky getting folks maybe who aren't computer literate?
Yeah. I think that's why smartphones are being viewed as a potential bridge in this technology. I think one thing that we've seen so far already is it takes a lot of hours of manual entry, and that's actually what the standard is today. When you sign up for this program, you literally get a huge binder, and it's about 3 or 4 inches thick, and you have to fill all this out. And obviously, if English is not your first language or whatnot, it's too much of a barrier. So what farmers do is they say, okay, I'm not going to worry about it, and they look somewhere else to sell. But obviously, those avenues of distribution are dwindling smaller and smaller with more folks requiring certification.
And do you have any component in here about worker safety? Because I know there have been cases where folks might have walked into a field and they just sprayed pesticide and either they didn't know or were unaware, and then some ended up in the hospital.
Absolutely. There's a big component of that, too. Pesticide spraying, pesticide, I guess abuse could be another perspective too, or just the unknown is a big factor. And I think just the pure education of all workers and employees on the field, as well as posted signs as well, is very important. I think the one thing that's really fascinating that we're really quite excited about is Hawaii, was at one point in time, especially during the plantation days, a agricultural hub. We led the world in many respects for a period of time. And, we also want to come back to those days, especially when we look at tourism and food tourism and obviously value production for products. So, because the fact that GAP is a global standard, you have Japan GAP, you have Korea GAP, you have, Thailand GAP everywhere. For us to be able to create this technology in such a multicultural mixing pot could have huge implications. And of course, to bring everyone here, and that's what we've been doing, especially in our stakeholder meetings, is trying to provide this avenue where we have this sharing of knowledge, information, and this collaborative environment. And that's what we have to do, right? We have to do this together. Otherwise, we're not going to be able to do it.
So exciting times for ag.
It is. Thank you.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
That was Vince Kimura with Smart Yields talking about the latest push to help get small farmers gain food safety certification.
If you haven't made it to the Atherton Studio yet, here's your last chance for the summer. On September 8th, join us for the Atherton debut of Kaimi Hananoeau. Known for his island rock with an edge style, he's equally adept at jazz, reggae, Hawaiian, and contemporary music. Make your reservations for this multi-talented artist at hprtickets.org. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
This is HPR One, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
It's now time for the reality check with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Managing Editor Jim Simon joins us with a peculiar development with the Big Islands County Council. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. It is indeed a strange story, one of the strangest ones I've come across in years of covering government and politics. This one comes from our Big Island columnist, Jason Armstrong, about Jen Ruggles, a Hawaii County Councilwoman from Puna, who announced that she can no longer really do her job with any legitimacy because she's afraid of committing a war crime against Native Hawaiians. On Tuesday, she was actually asked to leave the council meeting after she refused to vote because of her concerns. And these worries, based on the advice of her private attorney, is that by legislating and being complicit in the collections of taxes and setting other policies, she's essentially violating the U.S. Constitution and international law. And this is a position in support of Hawaii sovereignty, stemming basically from the overthrow of the Hawaii monarchy in 1893. And her position is, which is based on some, derives in part from a letter sent by an expert from the UN Human Rights Commission to the Hawaii judiciary. Her position apparently is that Hawaii is an occupied state and that the governing laws must be those of the Hawaiian kingdom. So she is concerned that she's acting illegitimately in her function as a Hawaii County Councilwoman, though she hasn't given up her seat, which expires in a couple of months.
Right. So this is a bit of a head scratcher because
yeah.
generally the incumbents have an edge, but it just sounds like she doesn't want to play ball.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, there is an odd backdrop to this. Ruggles this summer abandoned her reelection bid for a second term, even though the ballots had been printed. But she gave no public reason for withdrawing at that time. So, again, she's only going to be serving another few months. But it's interesting, when Ruggles first asked Hawaii County's council, who's a native Hawaiian himself, for a legal opinion about that, he told her that she would incur no legal or criminal liability. She didn't accept that advice and contends the county attorney is being negligent in his advice. In return, the county attorney during this meeting on Tuesday said, essentially told her, by not voting, you're doing a disservice to your constituents. Mm-hmm. He was quoted saying, when you abstain, you're not representing your district. And several other council members jumped on that as well. And I think they were baffled and surprised by all this. On the other hand, Ruggles has gotten some support for her stand. Kamala Nihehu, a doctor who's participated in the Pacific Caucus of the UN and is a medical officer for the Hokulea, told our reporter, told Jason Armstrong, you know, that this is something that really is being raised as a very legitimate question in this case.
But now, she's still on the payroll, though, right?
Right. She's on the payroll. And adding to the oddity of this is she says she has no choice to accept her salary for the time being, which I think is somewhere around $70,000 a year. I may have that wrong, because it's directly deposited to her bank account.
Okay, so we don't know if she's showing up to work or...
Yeah, I think that's a little unclear. I think she did walk out of the county council meeting when she said she wasn't voting and she was challenged on that. We don't know what the long term is, whether she's not going to attend these things or not going to vote in the future. It certainly seems that's what she's implying, though she keeps saying she's still going to work hard for her constituents.
Okay. Well, I'm sure her challengers are probably happy about that. One less person to worry about in the race.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And she finished, I think, third in the end in the balloting.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, thanks a lot, Jim. This is certainly one for the books.
You bet.
Okay.
Thanks.
That was Managing Editor Jim Simon with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org. Hawaii's art scene is dynamic, always changing with the times. Gallery spaces are contracting and expanding across the state. Artists are showing their work in cafes, restaurants, downtown offices, and even hotels. We check in on a new hotspot in Kaka'aka, which is combining artist studios with gallery spaces. Donnie Cervantes is the director for Aupuni Space, and he sat down with us in our studios yesterday to talk about the strides it's making to keep the local art scene vibrant.
Aupuni Space came from an idea called Aupuni Place, which was making use of vacant storefronts and spaces in Ward Warehouse when they were sunsetting. And this is all an initiative of something called the Pu'uhonua Society, which is in support of Native Hawaiian and Hawaii-based art and artists here. So we decided to open up a small dedicated gallery space and continue running a studio program for four artists. So at our new space on Oahu Street, which we opened in February, we have four working artists renting space, and we have an exhibition space downstairs. And it's in a garage space, so we have a big roll-up door. So basically it's like an indoor-outdoor. It's open to the air and light, and so it's pretty nice. So people walking by can see what's going on at any given time.
And so the space that you're in now, that was smaller than what you had at Ward?
Yeah, yes, yeah.
So tell us about that. Are there fewer opportunities for artists to show their work, or, you know, less space?
I think we're creating more opportunities for artists to show their work. The idea of using Ward Warehouse as an opportunity for people to have temporary studio space and temporary exhibition space was amazing, because it kind of created this, like, utopian place for a summer where different people were programming different exhibitions and keeping it really lively, and you could just kind of, the public got used to being able to show up there and see what was going on. And so Aupuni Space is a smaller version of that, because it's a feasible for the long run way to operate that we're finding. We do help artists sell their work. Like, my main goal is to foster and nurture and help artists living and working in Hawaii to grow their careers, whether it be through local collecting or other exhibition opportunities. So that's my main focus. And then it's also very much a community space where different things happen. It's not only an art gallery. In the in-between kind of times, or over the summer, I had like several different events to kind of let people program, self-program.
I imagine, though, if it's a collective, there's a kind of synergy going on.
Right. I'd call it a collective. It's not
okay.
Necessarily a collective, but there definitely is synergy going on there. There's something happening, because friends who come to, for instance, Kainoa Grusbe's show, they do have a collective, and they kind of approached me and said, hey, what do you think if we did this thing over the summer? It would be like a one-night thing. And that's like, yes, that's the first time somebody kind of came in and said, can we program the space on a temporary basis?
Like a pop-up?
Yep, a pop-up in between the normally scheduled exhibitions. But since then, we've done that, you know, almost every time. And it's great because it introduces the idea of that exhibition space to different audiences that wouldn't normally just come to an exhibition. So we're having a music show on Saturday night, for instance. Three different bands, local bands, are going to play there. And it's kind of like an all ages, no cover thing, because it's like an open air space. So there's no way to charge money for entry. And it's very much in our mission for it to be a community space where everyone's welcome and kind of try to program it in different ways.
So it's an art sandbox that
Sure.
everybody can play in, whether you're a musician or artist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We make room. We make room for all different kind of ideas.
What are the challenges? You say now you've got in studio space included.
Mm-hmm. The challenges, I think people who rent the studios have to be very motivated to be in there and making work, because they do pay money for them. So that's a challenge for an artist living and working here. If you're going to have a studio space that you have to, make the money to pay for it, and then hopefully make really good use of it. But right now it's a very much thriving space. We have really talented people in there that are serious about their careers. So there's different ways that we try to work with the community. We have some really great people that are bringing their collectors, and they're really making a point to bring friends who live, you know, their neighbors, to say, hey, look, this is happening. These are really talented people. I'm purchasing artwork from these people, you should too, and just kind of spread the word in that way. That's a big challenge.
And I know in the Kakaako area, there's talk about building housing for artists.
Yeah, we're actually going to host an info session at Aupuni Space for that group, so we can also hear, so everyone can hear, what is that about? Is that something that people should be applying to? And hopefully that'll be, you know, really beneficial to the community.
Right, so you want to find out, well, what's the criteria? Mm-hmm. How do you judge?
Exactly.
Is it going to be a lottery space? You want to make sure it's fair.
Yeah. We've met with them a couple of times and have, you know, given the endorsement of, okay, have an info session here. So let's figure out what are the nuts and bolts and how much is it actually going to cost, like affordable, quote unquote. And it seems to be so far so good. With Aupuni Space singularly is what I'm focused on as far as a gallery and a community space. I'm just trying to keep people kind of coming through. There are different people coming through. You know, Chinatown has First Friday, which has kind of gone through its different iterations. And I think there's some new energy, I feel like, over there. And that's something that we're dabbling in a little bit, helping, working with them. We kind of have like a window right now, like a storefront to hang a painting in, just as a presence in Chinatown. And I think that something great right now, and apparently there's like a, you know, it's on a schedule that in 3 to 5 years we'll probably lose that garage space in Kakaako because of the master plan, you know, the master plan that would design more housing and kind of take down those low-rise industrial spots that are really, you know, bustling
they're,
right
they're
now.
Fun
you know,
spaces.
Yeah, I mean,
they
there's
really
there's tons of industry going on there. There's, you know, all in those neighborhoods between Kakaako and Alamoana down on the waterfront. So hopefully it goes longer than 3 to 5 years, I'm hoping, you know.
Do you feel like, oh, gosh, you can just get kicked out again,
you know? That's what we know. That's what they've told us. So, but you just make the most of it. And I like your question about like longevity, because that's something that I think about all the time. It's like different projects in the local history of contemporary art have come and gone. And I always think about what was it at that kind of year three, year four, year five makes somebody think, oh, I just, you know, I got to move on or, you know, and how do we kind of future proof the idea of this gallery being sustainable and having some of the overhead covered by the studio rental, and so that, you know, we're not, you know, eating that cost, you know. And that's why so many kind of art spaces are, or there are art spaces in cafes or bars. So what we're trying to do is have a very specific and curate with intent an art space that is purely for, you know, viewing and experiencing.
You mentioned cafes. I mean, I went to an opening at an attorney's office, mm-hmm. showcasing their art. Mm-hmm. Even the hotels are using some space to showcase artists.
Yeah. There's an artist that I'm, you know, very close with had a show at Hale Kulani that's coming down, I think, any day now. So, yeah, Hadley Nunes at Hale Kulani. So catch it if you can. You know, it's a transient space because there's a lot of visitors coming, and we'll see how that, if that's like a relevant space to exhibit and sell work. I mean, a lot of the things that when we're selling work and kind of developing, it's about developing relationships with collectors. And so it's a lot of that. It's a lot of conversation, figuring out what people like, you know, a certain person, what their style is, so that you know, what to tip them off about or show them.
That was Donnie Cervantes with Aupuni Space. He says he's currently making connections to expand the program on the neighbor islands. And tomorrow, we talk to a new artist in residence at the Four Seasons Resort at Ko'olina. It's a fairly new direction for the luxury hotel and a big boost for Makakilo artist Eduardo Bolioli.
Lena Musa in a Tulumatife, the conversation Nana, Hawaii Public Radio.
Today we told you about the local book award created over a half a century ago in a Honolulu classroom. During the 1958-59 school year, third graders at the University Elementary Lab School held a contest to find the best children's fiction book whose author was still living. Now, this was the genesis of the Nene Award, and the first author to win a Nene was Beth Lewis for The Blue Mountain. By 1963, the award grew in popularity as other schools began to participate in choosing a favorite book. A year later, the statewide Nene Award was given to Scott Odell for Island of the Blue Dolphins. And starting in 1994, winners of the award began visiting Hawaii to receive the Nene and meeting with the children who voted for their books. So next year, you may see Cece Bell in town to pick up her Nene, awarded for her graphic novel, El Defo. And congratulations to Colette, a librarian from Honolulu. She knew the answer. That's today's quiz, and if you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you tuned in last week on Says You, you learned lots of things, like the ins and outs of snake charming.
Are there a lot of apprentice snake charmers? I'm just curious.
Apprentice.
Some of them suffer from reptile dysfunction, I might add.
I don't even know where we are anymore. I'm going to have to...
And what will you learn this week on Says You? Who knows?
This evening at 6:30.
Imagine a lay of parks. Well, a number of groups are pooling efforts to kick off a pop-up event that will showcase the promenade from Kaka'ako to Ala Moana here in Honolulu. Thanks to a grant from AARP and help from the Biki Bike Sharing Program, the Trust for Public Lands hopes to parlay the weekend event into an opportunity to tap into federal funds to improve and protect the green space of our urban parks.
Well, the Lay of Parks is going to be on Saturday, September 1st, which is the Labor Day weekend. And it's what folks in the urban, I guess, urbanists, new urbanists call a pop-up. It's a temporary connection of the shoreline path between three parks, Ala Moana Regional Park, Kiwalo Basin Park, and Kaka'ako Waterfront Park. And those three parks will be connected through signage, temporary ground chalk stencils, you know, think like those stormwater stencils with the fish on it, and passport stations that are located throughout the three parks. We're encouraging people to get out to experience the three different parks. There's an incentive. If you participate in the Lay of Parks Family Day, you visit three passport stations. There will be nine spread out throughout the parks, and get your passport stamped and fill out a really brief survey. You can be entered to win free prizes in a drawing, the best of which is two round-trip tickets donated by Alaska Airlines.
Oh, that's terrific.
Yeah, Alaska Airlines is very generous.
And so tell us, how does this activity fit in with your mission?
Well, the Trust for Public Land is part of the Lay of Parks Coalition, one of many community organizations and agencies. The Trust for Public Land's mission is to create parks and conserve land for people. So our mission has always been connecting people to the outdoors. And one of those ways is to connect them to their parks. This connection, the Lay of Parks, is actually a much bigger vision. For decades, the idea has existed in different plans, both state and county, to connect in a sort of network, if you would, of bike paths and walking paths and multi-use paths, Diamond Head, all the way to the west side. So, and that serves a number of benefits. There's health benefits, fitness, alternative transportation, reducing our carbon footprint, and just providing people access to the shoreline. That's something everyone has said that they would like to see improved in all these various planning efforts. Everybody wants to be able to access our shorelines and experience our beautiful, you know, beaches and nature. And there's some great organizations that are also having different activities throughout the day that are associated with Lay of Parks Family Day. So, for example, Beaky is having a social ride, or actually several social rides for 50 and over, and you can get like a free week of Beaky. Humana is going to give out free sunscreen that is coral-friendly samples. There's yoga by Courtney Waxler. There's historic sites walking tours by the Historic Hawaii Foundation. There's an exceptional trees tour by the Outdoor Circle. There is a keiki-friendly bike ride by Hawaii Bicycling League, and a walk with a dog where AARP Hawaii is going to be.
And AARP is one of the sponsors of this event. They helped to fund it?
Yes. AARP, the Community Challenge Program, is one of the main funders of the program. And then everyone else is kind of just contributing for free all of their sort of services and their time. Oh, I forgot to mention, I think one of the coaches at the Wahine Beach Volleyball team is also going to do like a youth-friendly beach volleyball clinic, actually two youth beach volleyball clinics.
Is that going to be at the beach volleyball court there?
Yeah, the new beach volleyball courts on the Eva end of Alamoana.
And with AARP, the whole idea is what? Just to make it senior-friendly, I think.
Right, age-friendly, so that to make our cities more age-friendly, so people can safely walk or bike and move about and be healthy, connect to each other, improve not only their physical health, but their psychological and sort of community cohesion.
And there's a lot going on right now during this time. I know the city is working on the development plans, which will look at the blueprint for urban Honolulu, not just growth, but also where do you want to keep the open spaces and how to protect those areas. I think the city's, you know, moving with the complete streets idea. I think they've got a series of meetings that they're launching to have the communities engaged in talking about, you know, where these things will go, you know, just to get input.
Yeah, and please, I hope the community members and the public participate in those processes and participate in this process and take the survey. As our population, especially in urban Honolulu, gets more dense, it's really important that, you know, people have easy access to parks, to nature, to ways to get outdoors. It's, you know, they've got a number of studies that show your psychological health is improved by being outdoors and in nature, and also connecting with other people in your community.
And so the feedback that you're collecting, how does that work? Because I know the state with the Hawaii Community Development Authority is looking at master planning Kiwalo Park, and then the city also has a master plan process for Alamoana Beach Park.
Right. Well, we're going to collect these survey responses, and it's very simple questions. You know, do you think these parks should be connected, and what would you like to see? We'll summarize that. We'll share it with everybody. We're also going to try to use that information and the survey responses to spur action on the part of the state and the county and encourage, you know, funding. There are federal programs that, you know, will provide 75% of funding for these kinds of shoreline, multi-use paths. And so there are some really good opportunities to get some federal funding for planning and for construction. And so the survey is kind of one of the first steps to getting there.
We often hear that, at least from the city, that they don't have enough money to do what they want to do. They're looking at somehow getting public-private partnerships going. So if they can get someone to sponsor something, maybe they get their name on McCoy Pavilion or whatnot, just to help with the upgrades and the maintenance of some of the parks.
Yeah, it's a very expensive proposition. And so I think we have to be creative about how we fund, you know, construction costs and planning costs of things like the lay of parks. And there are some definite opportunities out there, like the federal funding for 75%. The Trust for Public Land really wants to kind of just encourage that and help it as much as it can.
And you've been involved in protecting a lot of areas on the North Shore, along the Kaibi Coast. So now it's kind of urban Honolulu's time, I guess, to get some TLC.
Definitely, definitely. The Trust for Public Land has worked in urban cities for many, many decades. And although in Hawaii we've kind of concentrated on sort of open space and conservation lands in more rural areas, you know, we do want to encourage that connection between nature and the outdoors with people. And where are the people? The people are in the cities, right? And actually, the demographics of the United States are such that 80% or more of the population of the United States will be living in cities in the future. So we want to have impact on people, make people's lives better.
Okay, so probably it's probably more important now more than ever with all the density that's planned.
Yes, definitely. And as Honolulu gets more dense and more populated, it's very important that we look at alternative transportation. We look at providing families and communities with opportunities to connect to nature that are close to home. So, to be a healthy, livable community, we need to have that access to nature and the outdoors.
Okay. Lay of Parks, September 1st.
Yep.
All right.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here.
All right.
That was Leah Hong with the Trust for Public Land talking about a family-friendly event, a Leah of Parks Day, taking place Saturday from 9 to 3. Grand prize for participation, 2 round-trip tickets, thanks to Alaska Airlines.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, dedicating this message of thanks to all the donors, volunteers, and staff who help to improve the health of those affected by kidney disease. KidneyHI.org.
That's it for today. Up tomorrow, our Boys of Summer, our Little League champs, join the conversation. Would you like to send them your congratulations? Call our talkback line. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We're on Facebook at The Conversation and Twitter at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, Aloha Friday, for more of The Conversation.